Welcome to History's Nightfall podcast, exploring the secrets behind Nightfall and the truth about the Templars. My name's Dan Jones, historian, author, broadcaster, and consultant on Nightfall. And I'm here to unpack all the extra bits you'll ever need about the blockbuster historical drama. Now, there will be spoilers ahead, so please make sure you've caught up with the first episode before you continue on. The first episode. If you haven't caught up, you cannot write in and complain to me. Well, not for that reason, anyway. Right. This episode, I will be speaking to the writer and creator Richard Rayner, showrunner Dominic Minghella, and the star of the show, Tom Cullen. Obnoxiously handsome man, also very nice, great interviewee. And we're going to touch on why they wanted to make a show about the Knights Templar, and more specifically, why this particular period in history. Now, we'll also touch on filming the epic opening scene, the Siege of Acre, and how the production was nearly shut down, not once, but twice, before they even got going. Okay, here we are in episode one, and finally we've met our Templars. We find them in 1291 at the Siege of Acre, the last stand of the Christians in the Holy Land.
Nearly 200 years ago, nine knights founded our order to protect pilgrims on the road to Jerusalem. Today, Acre is our stronghold in the Holy Land, and we will never relinquish it. We fight for more than just this city, more than just the men and women who will die if it falls. Today, we fight for the Grail.
It's one of the most spectacular TV sequences you will ever see. Horses charging, fireballs flying through the air. But it ends with the Templars escaping on a boat, trying to take with them the holiest relic in the Holy Land, in their Holy Land anyway, the Holy Grail.
The Grail!
Fast forward 15 years, we meet them again in Paris. We meet Landry, a frustrated Templar knight who wants more than anything else to stop hanging around in Paris and get back to the Holy Land where they belong. We meet his master, Godfrey, who comes to a sticky end at the hands of a bunch of bandits. But while we're meeting those bandits, we come across a young farmer's boy called Parsifal, who has a big future in the order and a very peculiar name for his testicles. And finally, at the end of the episode, what's this? It's the Holy Grail again. Only it's found its way to Paris.
The Holy Grail is in France.
Now, the Knights Templar are a medieval military order. Put simply, that means they're warriors who live like monks. They're knights, they've trained their whole life to fight and kill other human beings, but they've also chosen to do this in God's name by taking vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They'd been around for almost 200 years, fighting in the Crusades. These were the wars that consumed the Holy Land, Spain, Portugal, and lots of other places beside during the Middle Ages. The Crusades had featured some of the Middle Ages' most famous names. Think about Richard the Lionheart on the one side or Saladin on the other. But the Templars had been there throughout. They'd been involved in battles in the mountains of Asia Minor, in the deserts of Palestine, amphibious warfare in the Nile Delta, fighting in cities, you name it, the Templars had been at the heart of it. But where we find them in Nightfall, things are looking a little bit rocky. In fact, the Templars are heading towards a very inauspicious day, Friday the 13th of October, 1307. Now, today we look back and say, why is Friday the 13th unlucky? Well, it was certainly unlucky for the Templars. This was the moment that the collapse of this amazing institution, which had been around for almost two centuries, began. Now, that's the premise for Nightfall. And who better to talk about taking all that history and making it into TV drama than writer and co-creator Richard Rayner? Richard Rayner, it's Dan Jones here. How are you doing?
How are you, Dan?
I'm very good. Where are you? The first thing I wanted to ask Richard was what drew him to this particular slice of Templar history, the downfall.
It was really just the realisation that I'd assumed it was Friday, October the 13th, 1307, as we all know. I had assumed that was the end of the story. And in fact, it really wasn't, that there was a seven-year to and fro, which involved tussles between England and France and their different attitudes towards the Templars, and along the way, various kind of types of Templar resistance, the movement led by Peter of Bologna, the disappearance of the document, the Chinon parchment that's described in Barbara Frale's book. And we thought, wow, you know, there's enormous material here. And we could begin as Lucas had begun at the end.
You know, Richard's referring here to creator of Star Wars, George Lucas.
When the Order's in decline and facing extinction. And then, if we so wished, we could go backwards in time later on in future seasons if we wanted to kind of revisit the Crusade.
Which actually right now, Richard, you know, in a sort of Hollywood environment where everything's an origin story, is kind of a bold thing to do, right?
I suppose, to start at the end, well, you know, we met with Michael Hirst, the great kind of creator of the Tudors and Vikings. And he said, oh, I would begin at the beginning, you know, and they're on Temple Mountain and they kind of dig, and that's the origin story. You know, we did along the way encounter a lot of people asking, well, why did you start at the end? And the answer was that sort of, you know, we felt the end was so rich and that it went on for so much longer than anyone really knew. There was the fact that someone started reprinting Maurice Druon's books, The Accursed Kings, the French historical novels that had been done in the 50s, that George R. R. Martin was then saying, oh, these were part of my basis for kind of Game of Thrones. And Druon begins his sequence of novels with de Molay's curse.
Jacques de Molay, who Richard just mentioned, was the last Grand Master of the Templars, who is said to have cursed his enemies when he was burned at the stake in 1314.
So that became a part of the argument that, oh, beginning at the end is not just the sort of seems story smart, but is also sort of at this moment in time potentially kind of more commercial, because we were able to reference both Star Wars and Game of Thrones, which,
right,
you know, executives like to hear.
Now, as Richard says, it's interesting to compare our knights in Nightfall to the Jedi of Star Wars. They're both two religious orders created to fight for good, but they've got the conflicting threat of the dark side within their own ranks. I called showrunner Dominic Minghella to talk about this unusual decision to start at the end of the story and how it allowed him to add real depth to Nightfall's characters.
I think that sort of sense of veterans who are questioning themselves and was a big element of it for me. I suppose the other thing about it is that these guys really existed. They really were Templars. And when you're creating story and, you know, writing characters, it really helps if you think there really were people who might have had dilemmas, something like this. Who, you know, there's something it's like to be a Templar is a kind of mantra that came back to me and to the writing and production team again and again. You know, it begins with reality, and that's a good thing.
Did you look at, or indeed consciously ignore, all the other representations of Templars from popular culture? And I'm obviously thinking of the Da Vinci Code or Indiana Jones or whatever.
They exist in the background, and of course everybody's seen them, and even if you kind of try not to look and try not to remember, they kind of, you know, they are part of the cultural world that, you know, that the audience will have in their minds and bring to the table when they see our show. So you can't run away from them, but I did try to. Like I said to you before, I think the thing for me was to hang on to not the pre-existing treatments of the Templars, but our sense that these were real guys, you know. So I'd rather sort of make up a world or develop, you know, work around and towards the historical, the big events, the tentpole events, and think about that, and think about, you know, finding a story, what it might have been like to be there on the ground when this stuff really happened. So in the end of the day, creating an entertainment is about fantasy. Mm. We're right in the fringes of fantasy and what could credibly be believed or have been believed by people who were alive then, rather than the sort of full scale, you know, you press a hidden button in a stone wall and the walls move, was something we toyed with and got very close to doing, but in the end we decided not to do. So our story was always trying to walk this side of the line of possibility and reality.
In the siege of Accra, right at the beginning, where we have that scene of Landry's face very close up inside the helmet as they charge, which I think I don't remember ever having seen on, and I've watched a few medieval shows, but I don't remember having felt that claustrophobic within a suit of armour before. And then later on, when there's the battle in the woods, you suddenly have them charging into battle without the helmet. Now, which gives you a beautiful tableau of all the knights when, you know, you shoot it in slow motion and you see them together, which simply wouldn't have worked with helmets on. So do you feel like overall you've got the balance right on the show?
I mean, I think, you know, it's like looking at your own face in the mirror. You're never going to say, I think it looks great. All you see is the spot. So I'll never say yes to that question. But I think, you know, you raise a brilliant point, which is, you know, you want to sort of be arresting and be inventive, which is what we did and what Douglas brilliantly did with that, the helmet.
Dominic's referring to Douglas MacKinnon here, who directed many of the episodes.
The helmet cam, as we called it, and we're patenting that, and no one else may ever.
How did you do it? Are we allowed to ask?
No, I'd have to kill you.
Oh.
And you know, we wanted to rethink as best you can, you know, in the limited time and resource world that you work in, what can we do that shows we've really thought about it and we're trying to be fresh and original and true to the fact that they'd be in this heavy stuff and be hard to communicate with each other and just, you know, take the audience there for a minute. And then later on, you need to get to see the faces of the people who are actually fighting.
Yeah.
And they weren't fighting. They were fighting rogues rather than an army.
Yes.
And the other elements you kindly didn't mention, but is kind of similar, is they would have fought on their horses probably.
I was very annoying during production to you. I remember, and I used to say, why aren't they on their horses? They should be on their horses.
Yeah,
and you were so good about it.
You're kind not to mention it now, but the. I brought it up, you know, but obviously then it wouldn't be much of a fight. And dramatically, do you love your Templars for, you know, riding a coach and horses through people? Or do you want them to get down and dirty and fight on equal terms? And you kind of, you know, that's a storytelling, really, as well as obviously massive budget consideration. Because anything with horses takes 2 and 3 times as long.
Yes.
I mean, the Templars are always going to win, but it's a kind of air fight. It's not, they haven't ridden through with the medieval equivalent of Sherman tanks, you know.
Of course, yeah. Talking to Dominic, I couldn't help remembering just how viscerally affected I'd been seeing those first shots when we find our knights charging through Accra and we kind of see right inside their helmets.
Victory! On your left! Victory behind you!
Landry!
And I really wanted to drill down a little bit more into how that was done, but also how it felt.
This was from the mastermind of our Unit 1 director, Douglas MacKinnon. He was in charge of kind of creating the look and feel of the show.
I called actor Tom Cullen, who plays our hero Landry, and he gave us his first-hand take on filming inside the helmet.
Every film comes across when you're touching on medieval work is that in the battle sequences, you can't tell who's who.
Mm.
And you don't want to not wear the helmets because that isn't authentic. And so he devised this camera that goes inside the helmet, which is, I think he took it from watching Formula One, where they've now got these cameras inside the driver's helmet so they can see what's going on. And it's this incredible kind of intimate, dynamic shot in which you can see everything crossing the driver's faces, from their fear, from the G-forces that they're experiencing, from the excitement of winning a race. And so he kind of came up with this fantastic idea that from outside, these men look like fearsome units of steel and metal. But inside, you get to see what really happens inside that kind of anonymous outfit, which is a human being, a human relationship to the bloodshed and the warfare. Douglas really wanted to push that to take a life isn't easy, and that every kill you take, every life you take, every kill you make, God, I'm sounding like that sting. really mean something.
Master Godfrey, who I will now forever think of as the Sting of the medieval period, echoes this in his stirring speech at the beginning of the episode.
Take every life you must take, but no more.
We sometimes have this perception of the Knights Templar as being these evil cult overlords, but we've got to remember that in this show we're looking at the protectors of pilgrims, warrior monks, who are battling for the lives of the people of Accra inside these helmets.
And so he wanted to see the personal experience of warfare. And I think that it really adds a very visceral feeling to that opening sequence. And when we shot it, what was very interesting is that we all had, four of us, including Sam Hazelbean, who plays Godfrey.
Medieval Sting.
All four of us had very different and unique experiences inside the helmet, and that really translates. I think Tancred, there's a kind of not fear, but a kind of seriousness to the battle. Whereas Landry, he's laughing and having the time of his life. This is what he feels like he's made to do, with no kind of concept of his own mortality.
I think we need to hear that again. Landry there, having a blast. Accra is a city on the coast of what's now northern Israel, but the battle scenes in the show were filmed a few hundred miles across the Mediterranean in Dubrovnik, Croatia. Despite having a slightly more favourable climate than the Holy Land of 1291 and fewer marauding Mamluks, the Nightfall team was still filming in intense heat. With all that armour weighing them down while they were swinging swords about their heads, they must have had at least some sense of what it was like back then.
Well, what I'd realised is that those men, they're a different breed of man than the one that we are today. I mean, that was a trial by fire. That was, you know, you're carrying 23 kilograms and it was 40-degree heat, which for Americans is, I think, like...
1,000 or whatever.
Odd. Yeah, 1,000 Fahrenheit. Yeah. We were doing 12-hour days. I had to do this one fight, which was consistently fighting for 9 hours straight. But that doesn't compare to what these guys are doing. I mean, our costume was heavy, but they were wearing steel. Mm-hmm. They were carrying big, like, steel swords, and they were fighting for real, nonstop, with the adrenaline that comes through protecting your life. I mean, these guys were the real men, you know, that I think has been somewhat diluted out of us, which is, I think, a good thing. But, you know, they're a different breed of animal.
Hearing Tom talk there about shooting the Siege of Accra was amazing. It's exactly consistent with what everybody who came back from that shoot said. It was hot, it was exciting, it was incredibly draining. For me, I wasn't there, but I remember seeing it on the big screen for the first time and being so struck by it because it took me back to the day that Richard Rayner and his co-creator and writing partner Don Handfield first sent me the Nightfall pilot script. I remember reading that opening sequence and just being blown away by the blending of real history with fiction, with legend, and this huge TV action. It turned out Richard and the writing team had been heavily influenced by their reading of a classic Templar history book.
I'm blanking on which book this is. I can picture it.
Richard sent us an email later on saying it's The History of the Knights Templar by Charles G. Addison.
One of the 19th century books about the Templars. And it had a really, really, really vivid description of Acca. And we knew that we wanted to kind of start with action. And when you read, as we did, kind of descriptions of the fall of Acca, it's just this absolutely epic event with that goes on over a long period of time, with the massive army and the massive siege engines that come down, with the breach in the wall, the supposed betrayal through the tunnels, the charging horses coming out of the gates of the temple through the streets to confront the Mamluks. It's just incredible stuff.
And we have that all from 13th century accounts, don't we? The Temple of Tyre, yeah. You know, this is like people who are there wrote this down in the same detail we see in Nightfall. That's what like amazes me.
Yeah, no, it's a bit, and I think that kind of some of those details, because there were chronicles, and it's so vivid. The horses charging through the streets and incredible. And obviously, we wanted a great action set piece that looked like a very good place to start it, because it's the moment when they get kicked out of the Holy Land. They imagine for a long, long time afterwards. And at one moment in the story process, we were playing much more into the idea that the kind of beginning of the conversation when we pick up with the Templars again in 1306 would be about the kind of determination to get back to the Holy Land. Mm. And there would be more of that. And it may be indeed in season two that there will be more of the kind of politics around what was happening, because they didn't know it was over. They still dreamed that they could get back to the Holy Land in 1306 and even 1307. So placing our characters there was something that was right from the start, right from the very, very first draft we did. There was an extremely, how cool, you know, looking over the wall, kind of exterior Siege of Acca day, you know, 200,000 Mamluks, et cetera, et cetera. You know, now go ahead and film that.
and they did.
Mamluks, they did.
Now, as spectacular as Nightfall is, and as big and bold and beautiful as this first episode is, I guess what most people won't realise is that along the way, the production hit some serious problems. Not least when medieval Paris, this beautiful set that had been built on the back lot at Barrandov Studios in Prague, burned down in the course of an afternoon. And I remember going out and seeing it. I mean, literally burned to the ground. For me, it was kind of heartbreaking. For Dominic Minghella, as the ultimate executive producer in charge of the whole show, it was a nightmare.
The day the backlot burned down was not a great day, let's be honest with ourselves. The effects of it went on not just for, you know, the few following weeks, but are still ongoing, really, in that the finished product took so much longer to put together, because no episode could be completed until we finished shooting at the end of December last year. And in fact, one of the scenes for episode one, the first act of episode one, was the last thing we shot in the 21st of December, or whenever it was, in the very last scene that we shot. So Then the job of putting it all together had to happen after principal photography, whereas if we hadn't been struck down by the gods, we would have been delivering episode three or four by then. We would be very much further advanced. So the practicalities of it were immense and terrifying. But I think, I think in some ways, you know, it bound us all together. You know, there's this kind of togetherness in adversity, and we've got to just keep going. And when, you know, inevitably that meant a few more weeks filming and everybody was up for the fight, and it brought us together even more as a family than we were before, and it had some interesting positive knock-ons. For instance, we were filming episode 10 later than anticipated, which meant it snowed, and so then we embraced the snow in the production, and it made episode 10 look extraordinary and different, and really supported the story that episode 10 delivers. So there were some great side effects to it, but my mental health was probably one of the casualties. And there are probably insurers crying somewhere in a in a field in England. Someone who used to be a member of Lloyd's of London and is no more. Along with, you know, we've all forgotten that on day, you know, almost the first hour of filming, Simon Merrill's dressed to the nines in 30 kilos of armour, slipped off the end of the slipway in Dubrovnik and had to be rescued by divers. And, you know, I did think my show was over within, you know, a few hours of the cameras rolling. So that was a bad day. But so almost the only thing that's, you know, could be as bad or nearly as bad as somebody actually being hurt, is your set burning to the ground. So it wasn't a good day.
Simon Merrills, who Dominic mentioned just then, plays Tancred, one of our leading Templars who will go on to be Landry's right-hand man. Now, you'll remember Landry and Tancred were fighting their way through the crowd with the Grail to the ship when Landry spots a Jewish man in distress.
Landry, what are you doing?
Don't wait! Get the Grail on the ship!
The box is secure. Castor!
No, wait! Landry!
Simon's contribution to that first day's filming left an impression on everyone involved, including Richard Rayner.
Yeah, absolutely. On the very first day, while kind of charging down the jetty, the explosions going off, Simon Merrill's Tancred missing the jump onto the boat and dropping into the water on almost the first take. And
Simon.
As
only Simon could have done that.
As he sank down, we thought, oops, there goes the show right there. fortunately, scuba divers were on hand to bring him back up.
Now, besides the anecdotes and the history behind the show, one of the things I want to explore on this podcast is the historical, or occasionally not so historical, minutiae that make up the world of Nightfall. While I had Richard on the phone, I decided to ask him about something that's been bugging me for a while.
Whenever I watch the first episode of Nightfall, there's one tiny detail that grabs me more than anything else, and that's Tancred's tiny tattoo behind his ear. Which the first, you know, and he's got this tiny tattoo of a cross behind his ear?
Yeah.
Where did he get that tattoo, man?
I think you probably need to ask Simon.
Well, actually, you know what? There is in Jerusalem, there's a tattoo parlour. I think it's called Razouk Tattoo Parlour. We're giving them a bit of free publicity here. Who claim to have been going since 1300. And if you go to Jerusalem now on as a Christian on pilgrimage, they will do you a little I Went on Pilgrimage tattoo, which they claim to be doing for generation after generation. So in my mind, anyway, I believe that that Tancred went in 1300 on a mission back to Jerusalem for some purpose I haven't quite elucidated, and got a tattoo, a little subtle tattoo. Do you think that passes muster?
I think that passes muster. I think we need to see that happen.
Now, I've got my quibbles and my queries about Nightfall, as you just heard there, but I want yours too. So a couple of weeks ago, I put the word out asking for questions about the show. And actually, one of the first I got back, and more than once, was, am I in it? And I would absolutely love to say that, yes, I'm in it. I'm turning up as a kind of hero knight in episode 7. But actually, that's not the case at all. It's not for want of trying. I kind of made sure every time I was out in Prague that I would get I would offer up my services as a reader at the round table read-throughs. This is when the actors get a new script and they sit around a table, literally, and read out their parts. Well, if an actor's not there,
anyone who's sort of kicking about in the corridors looking like a lonely historian, which is kind of my role, can get roped in. So I would be roped in willingly to these sessions and really give my reading of these parts a rip, with the hope of impressing, you know, Dominic Minghella or the director of whichever unit was filming at the time. And the best response that I got, which wasn't very good, was after I'd been reading the part of a drunken brawler in a fight outside a tavern, which was to be included in a later episode. And on the way out, Douglas MacKinnon, one of the directors, who can be quite a cutting man, just said to me that he liked that I'd played the drunken brawler so camply. So I'm not in Nightfall, but I haven't given up. So if you want to see me in season two, or more to the point, you actually have good questions for the talented people who can act who are in season one, head over to Facebook and Twitter and search for Nightfall and History, or tweet using hashtag Nightfall, and I'll do my best to address them here. So what's coming up next time? Well, in episode two of the podcast, we're going to speak to Simon Merrills, who plays Tancred, about that dice with death in Dubrovnik and the tattoo behind his ear. And we'll also be hearing more from Tom Cullen about what went into playing Landry. Thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.